This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour.
Hello there, and thank you for listening to us. I'm Joel Hilliker. Every year, leaders from about 70 of the world's major nations gather to debate international security policy at the Munich Security Conference. This conference was held this past weekend, and it is clear the alliance between America and Europe is broken. This was one of several points of prophetic interest that emerged from this year's conference. We'll talk about this with Richard Palmer. This coming Friday, Iran will hold parliamentary elections. A lot of people are looking at Iran for signs that this nation is on the cusp of abandoning its radicalism. The economy is hurting from sanctions. The populace has been rising up in protest. But if you look how it is gearing up for these elections, you'll see that these hopes are misplaced. We're going to talk with Trumpet writer Callum Wood about how these elections are likely to make Iran even more hardline than it already is. And then we'll talk about extreme dieting. If you're trying to lose weight or looking for other major health benefits, a host of diets promise you the results that you want. We're going to talk with holistic nutritionist Jorg Mardian about some principles that will help you to know whether the diet you're looking at is solid or if it's a fad that might actually do more damage than good. And I'll conclude the program by talking about the importance of emotions. We'll start, though, by talking about the Munich Security Conference. To talk about this, we have via Skype from our office in Britain, Trumpet writer Richard Palmer. Hello, Richard.
Good afternoon.
So, Richard, if you would, start by talking about the importance of this conference and the kinds of issues that tend to get decided at the Munich Security Conference.
So it's a conference that was set up more during the Cold War era, where for Europe and America to get together and talk about their mutual security. Because you look at this through a kind of a Cold War lens, this was the West. This was the main, you know, this was NATO. This is the part of the world that's defending the world against communism and this you know, the evil empire that wanted to take over. So the two of them would get together, two sides would get together at the Munich Security Conference, and not just politicians, academics, people at the top, but also defense ministers and people kind of that next level down, so that they could coordinate their military policy, so that they could work together and just talk about the future of this alliance.
Mm-hmm. So it's independent from NATO, but the main membership essentially constitutes the main members of NATO.
Right. And in the post-war world, they've brought more people in. I think
there's
Iran's
about 70 nations altogether that attend now.
Right. And even Russia and China will send representatives these days, and Iran and Saudi. They've had a kind of Iranian and Saudi Arabian leaders both come as they try and solve problems in the Middle East. So it's not just focused on transatlantic ties anymore, but it's still centered around this relationship. And it's often viewed, especially for Germany, because it's in Germany. But it's really viewed with a lot of importance there. And when Germany's made big military announcements, it's often come at the Munich Security Conference. You know, people still talk to this day about the 2014 conference, I think it was, where the Germans showed up with an unambiguous message at that conference. We're not going to hide behind our history. We're going to remilitarize. Germany is back. Germany is going to be a normal power again. We're going to be taking part in military missions. We are back in the world. And it was a 2014 Munich Security Conference where they made all of those declarations. So it's especially significant for Germany's military policy.
So the theme of the conference this year, quite provocative, Westlessness. And the fact is that Britain was not even in attendance. Talk about that a little bit, why that is, and does this start to give us a picture of what European policy is going to look like after Brexit?
Yeah, it's just a bizarre story that the Prime Minister didn't come. I believe he was invited. If he had come, he would have been up there kind of on the stage alongside Mike Pompeo, the U.S. Secretary of State, and all of these German and European leaders and Macron. He didn't even send the defense minister. And I don't think anyone really knows quite what to make about that. I mean, Britain still talked about having some kind of military relationship with Europe after Brexit. So that decision to stay away was just bizarre. And I think perhaps exposes a blind spot to Europe that Britain's now just happy to, well, we're doing our thing. You just kind of do whatever. We're not even going to keep an eye on it. But it certainly did allow us to get a glimpse of what Europe is like post-Brexit. There was no Britain there to be up on stage and to moderate things. You know, French President Emmanuel Macron was really pushing hard for a united European military and a strong European power. And there was no British presence there to say, well, hang on. Yes, we're all for a military alliance, but NATO's got to be the most important, and we're not too keen on giving up our military. Just those breaks that Britain traditionally put on, they were completely absent from the Munich Security Conference, and it gives you a glimpse of what Europe's like with that completely absent from European policymaking.
Mm-hmm. So you bring up French President Emmanuel Macron. Germany is going through a serious leadership crisis right now, as we've been following. We've been talking about a lot on the program. Macron seems intent on filling the void. In some ways, he's the most prominent pro-Europe voice out there, and we really saw that on display here at this conference.
That's right. I think Deutsche Welle had some good analysis where they wrote, the highlight of this conference was perhaps the appearance of French President Emmanuel Macron. The French president brings incredible dynamism to the European debate. He fights for European independence. He wants a common foreign and defense policy. Macron talks about how Europe cannot just be America's junior partner. Very clear that he wanted to be independent from the United States. Now, there were some Eastern European countries that did kind of sound the more of the British perspective that, Where we're not sure on being part of this big European military conglomerate. Actually, we'd kind of like to be more dependent on the United States, or we'd like to rely. We think United States is a better partner. But what Macron was up there saying was that if Europe has to move forward with just a core group, if not everybody in Europe is on board with this, if some of these Eastern European nations and these smaller nations don't want to move forward with this, he's fine with that. And he made very clear that he's perfectly happy to push forwards on this idea of a military Europe with just a small core of nations, leaving some of those other ones that maybe think a bit more like Britain behind. And then you had the response of Germany to this, where exactly like you said, Germany did not have any strong leader in general or at this conference. They didn't stand out as pushing the lead on this, but they made very clear they were very happy with what Macron was doing there. Just about every German politician that attended the Munich Security Conference was very in favor of Macron's ideas. For example, Armin Laschet, he's one of the key candidates to replace Angela Merkel. He said, I would like to apologize on behalf of the German government for not doing more along pushing to a European military in the way that Macron wants. The foreign minister, Heiko Maas, he said, for too long, we Europeans have shut our eyes to the uncomfortable reality of what a withdrawal of the U.S. from the military engagement and from what international treaties mean for us. And he called for the construction of a European security and defense union. And he called for setting up this new union within 10 years. Annegret Kramp-Karrenbauer, formerly the next in line to be Germany's chancellor, now merely the defense minister, she said she completely agreed with Macron. So Germany lacks the strong leader to push this forward within Germany, to remilitarize Germany. But at the same time, their entire political class is absolutely on board and really enthusiastic about what Macron is pushing.
It's fascinating to watch this dynamic between these two countries, Germany and France, the strongest nations within the European Union for quite some time. And there's been a bit of push and pull between the two over who will take the dominant position within Europe. It's pretty clear that in just about every way other than the leadership that Germany is the dominant nation between the two. And yet here you have Macron, who's we're looking at this from the standpoint of Bible prophecy, knowing that Germany will be the leader in a 10-nation conglomeration within Europe. The fact that you have France, as our editor-in-chief has talked about a lot, France actually being at least largely Israelite, this sort of iron and clay mixture within Germany, the fact that it's France, that it's Macron that's pushing for this, and Germany is kind of saying, well, yeah, that's right, we agree with France. It's just a very interesting dynamic that you see playing out before Germany actually has the leader who's willing to take this and steer the ship himself.
Yeah, it really suits them. I think, you know, they lack the leader, but then also, you know, they have that historical baggage of people. If German right. leaders start making these comments about a European military, it makes people much more nervous than if France does it.
Yep.
So they benefit a lot by France having that push. And he is really, you know, he even dangled nuclear weapons at the conference. So we talked about that on Friday's show and about how this discussion has come out. And he basically invited countries that want to move forwards with a European military to, well, we can talk about a shared European nuclear deterrent or having nuclear drills and that kind of thing. So he's putting a lot out there to empower Europe and empower Germany. And it's I think a massive help for them what he's doing now while they don't yet have a strong leader there.
So the theme of the conference, Westlessness, it is very interesting. And they're clearly talking about what has been happening with this divide that you see developing between the United States and Europe, and to some extent, I'm sure, between Britain and Europe. Talk about just how this rift between America and Europe showed up at this conference.
Yeah, this is a theme. It's shown up at quite a few of the conferences, even before President Donald Trump became U.S. president. Even under Mr. Obama, there was talk of this divide, talk about his, you know, pivot to Asia and Europe doing, or America doing less within NATO. But then you had, yeah, absolutely, this sense from everybody except for the U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo, that you had this growing divide between the two, and that these two sides of this previous alliance were on completely different courses. Deutsche Welle again, they talking about this conference, they wrote, "One thing is certain, there will be no return to the heyday of close transatlantic ties. Rhetorically, at least, the Europeans have been shaken awake from that dream. There is much talk of Europe becoming a sovereign strategic political power. There are demands that Germany once again learn the language of power, which French President Emmanuel Macron has already seemed to master." So, you know, Europe sees this relationship as over. I think Europe has really succeeded in getting their narrative across about this relationship. I wrote on this a few years ago, but Europe has benefited enormously from the strategic alliance. It has been, you know, very one-sided. You look at America spending something like 6% of its economy on its defense, whereas Europe, a lot of countries are spending 1.5% of their economy. You know, that's a huge proportion that America's spending, and a lot of that spending pays for Europe's security. Mm-hmm. And Europe has built up all of these massive welfare states because America is basically subsidizing their security, and they don't have to mount the full costs for that. Europe has been taking advantage of the United States in trade for a whole number of years. So Europe has gotten a whole lot out of this relationship. Now, under President Trump, he's up there and he's saying, well, no, we're not going to have this one-sided relationship anymore. And so Europe's prepared to walk away if they're not going to have it the way that it was, and get all of their benefits. Then, you know, then they're saying, well, we're done with you. We're not interested in renegotiating the relationship. If that's not the way that it is, it's over. And you saw this at the meeting as well, with Macron was kind of pushing for a renewed European relationship with Russia, which is exactly, again, what Germany has wanted and what Germany has developed. And he made some pretty strong statements about Europe pivoting to Russia.
And all of this is we've been talking about for decades. With respect to Bible prophecy, this rift between the United States and Europe that we see increasingly on display, even the turn by European nations to some kind of accommodation with Russia is something that we've talked about quite a bit. We'll put links in the show notes to articles that provide relevant context for some of those things. Anything else that stood out to you from this conference? Any other takeaways that you'd like to share, Richard?
Well, I think that prophetic point is just the main one, that you know, Bible prophecy really did speak loud and clear at that conference. I mean, in just so many of these different ways, just about everything we've talked about ties right into that. You know, Emmanuel Macron's statements about how we want a European military, and if we leave some nations behind, well, we're fine with that. I mean, we've been saying for years, the Bible talks about a 10-nation European combine where these 10 nations share their strength and power with the European Union. There's 27 nations in the European Union right now. So we've said for years, watch for that to shrink. And you saw Emmanuel Macron saying that. And then just the whole dynamic, this whole westlessness relationship between Britain and the United States. It is, you know, so like what the Bible describes, where the Bible talks about it. It kind of paints this metaphor for this relationship where the United States really gives gifts, hires these foreign lovers, these allies as lovers, lavishes them with gifts, believes that this lover really loves her, but they don't. Mm-hmm. And the hired lovers turn against them. And I think you see that dynamic where Mr. Pompeo was there at the Munich Security Conference saying everything is fantastic in this relationship. It's absolutely great. And all the European countries were saying, well, if you're not going to give us these gifts anymore, we're going to turn on you. And again, that's exactly the dynamic that the Bible talks about. And then, like you said, Trumpet editor-in-chief Gerald Fleury is really focused on France's role in that turnaround where Europe turns against the United States, and France really betrays the United States by empowering Germany and helping Germany turn against the U.S. And you know, just in the latest Trumpet edition, the March 2020 Trumpet print edition, he has that article, France is resurrecting the Holy Roman Empire. And you saw that whole article really on display in the Munich Security Conference. So much of that proven right. And that's a great place to start to understand the Bible prophecy that was really shouting very loudly from Munich this weekend.
Excellent analysis. Thank you for that, Richard. We've been talking with trumpet writer Richard Palmer about the Munich Security Conference. He's working on a trumpet brief that should go out later today about this subject. Watch for that. And if you're not a Trumpet Brief subscriber, I'd encourage you to take advantage of this free service we provide. It's an email each day with a message from one of our writers, including our editor-in-chief. He's been producing a number of Trumpet Briefs lately. Just go to the front page on thetrumpet.com. There's a box a little ways down that page where you can subscribe. Thanks so much, Richard.
Thanks for having me.
This is the voice of the Trumpet News Magazine. You're listening to Trumpet Hour.
Iran is scheduled to hold parliamentary elections on Friday, and all indications are that it's going to become even more extreme politically than it already is. To talk about this, we have via Skype from our office in Australia, trumpet writer Callum Wood. Hello, Callum.
Hello, thanks for having me on the show.
Yeah, it's been too long. It's good to have you back. So if you could start by describing the Iranian political system a bit and how the supreme leader really is the one in ultimate control here.
Right. Well, basically, when you look at the Iranian political system, there are a lot of councils and there's a lot of tiers to this government. But of course, we know that at the very top is the supreme leader, the Ayatollah Khomeini at the moment. And beneath him is a council called the Guardian Council. And beneath the Guardian Council is the Iranian Parliament. Now, the Iranian Parliament, they have their elections every so often. Last one was in 2016. And of course, we have one coming up here on February 21st. And so with this tiered system of government, what we've seen, generally speaking, over the years, is that the Guardian Council and the Parliament will basically kowtow to the Ayatollah and his wishes, and simply follow in line with what he wants. And the way that the setup is created is in a way that no one really has the power to challenge the Ayatollah in a great way. The only time that the parliament really comes into its own in any way would be when it comes time for a new Ayatollah to be elected. Now, the current Ayatollah, he's had his health scares over the years, but he seems to be firmly seated in power. But you never know, in the world that we live in, when a new leader might be brought onto the scene. And in such a moment, the parliament would have an impact on who that would be. And the reason for this is, if I could just explain how a new Ayatollah is chosen, I'll try and keep it as simple as I can because it is a multi-layered thing. But basically, you have what's called the Council of Experts. Now, this Council of Experts is chosen by the Guardian Council. Now, the Council of Experts picks the new Supreme Leader. But this Council of Experts is chosen by the Guardian Council, and the Guardian Council is chosen by the Ayatollah. However, the Parliament also has a role in picking half of the people who form the Guardian Council as well. So it's a responsibility shared between the Ayatollah and the Parliament. So you can see when a new Ayatollah is brought into power, well, the Parliament will have a big say because they obviously have take part in choosing the Guardian Council, who chooses the people who choose the Supreme Leader. But you can see that there's this step-by-step process, but in a nutshell, the Parliament gets the opportunity to help select those who will choose the new leader.
Now, elections and Parliament, these sound like very democratic institutions that Iran is participating in. But the fact is that for someone to make it to be able to actually stand in an election, they have to pass muster with the Guardian Council. And the Guardian Council has a history of being very selective in who it allows to stand for Parliament to make sure that they get the results that they like. Maybe you could talk a little bit about the history of the Guardian Council in how they've controlled this and how this election shows even greater stringency in that process than what we've seen in the past.
Absolutely. So the Guardian Council, they get to choose who gets to run for the Parliament. So they have the veto process, basically. They act as a filter. And historically, ever since the revolution in 1979 onwards, they've always been quite stringent. They've vetoed quite a few people who've come up for, who've applied to run, to be members of Parliament. Now, this time around, though, it's unprecedented that they've been really working hard to veto a lot of people. And when you look at who's being vetoed and who's being stopped from running for or recontesting their seat, when you look at who's being stopped, it's all of those who would be considered quote-unquote moderate. And I use the quote-unquote because even moderates in Iran are not really moderate. We saw with the killing of Qasem Soleimani and those sort of things, we saw, you know, unanimously the parliament stood up and chanted death to America and things like that. So there's no moderate angle to the parliament. But even then, even when you look at the whole scope of the parliament, the least radical, you might say, not radical enough for the Guardian Council. So about 16,000 applicants put their names forward to be a part of it, which is quite a large number. And the last time I checked on the number, it was about 9,000 of those had been disqualified from even running. And so what that, of course, does is that you have a lot of these areas around Iran where these applicants go up against one another. And in a lot of areas, the quote unquote moderates are saying, well, hey, we don't even have a candidate there anymore. So it's a, you know, it's a one horse race. So of course, what's happening is that you have these areas where there's these radicals now who are just going in uncontested. It's not even a vote anymore because they're just going in on their own. Or best case scenario, you have one radical versus another radical. So what are the Iranian people supposed to do? Choose the lesser of two evils.
So if I'm understanding this correctly, there were many of the men who passed these checks in the past who are just running for re-election, and this time they're actually being eliminated, showing that the requirements that the Ayatollah and the Guardian Council are demanding here are even greater than they were in the past.
Absolutely, and it's no small number there either. The parliament has 290 members. So it's a big group, but 90 of those have been barred from running again. Mm. And so when we think about that, I mean, you think about how the Guardian Council is really they're tightening the process. And so regardless of what the election outcomes are in the very near future, regardless of what it is, we're going to see a parliament that the Guardian Council wants. And what the Guardian Council wants is what the Ayatollah wants. Mm-hmm. And so we're seeing him, what he's doing by this is he's shaping the future of Iran in a lot of ways, because, you know, next time Parliament votes on a Guardian Council member, or voting who's going to be in the Guardian Council, who's going to get to choose the next Ayatollah, well, of course, it's going to be all very pro-Ayatollah people. It's going to be all the hardliners that are coming into power. And so the moderates are saying, look, you know, out of all of these 290 seats, you know, most of those they're saying are going to be filled with hardliners. I think they said they don't even have candidates for 230 of the possible openings. Mm.
So it's hard not to see this in light of recent events. For quite some time, there were protests against the Ayatollah, against the ruling class in Iran, the public basically saying we're unhappy with the direction that our country is taking. And the Ayatollah was cracking down pretty hard on those protesters. It seems like this is yet another means by which he is putting down any hope that there may have been in the Iranian populace of there being any kind of political change.
Absolutely. I mean, this is a real power grab. I mean, we look back at 2016 and particularly for, I think, the Western media really wanted to latch a hold onto anything that they saw as a positive move in Iran's political system. And so in 2016, we saw quite a few moderates came into power in the parliament. We saw, for instance, Tehran. I forget exactly how many seats, but I think it's about 12 seats there are in Tehran itself. And they were all taken by quote-unquote moderates. And, of course, then you had Rouhani in power as well, the president, and everyone, of course, thinks of him as a great moderate, and the Trump had warned about that facade that he was putting up back when he was first elected. And so when now, of course, what we see is even those gains, those, you know, that the media was so quick to jump on and the Western world was really praising, these moderate gains and the moderate movement that they saw and was backed up by, as you mentioned, the riots and whatnot. Everyone thought, hey, this is maybe moving in a positive direction for some good political change in Iran. The Ayatollah has said, nope, not today. And he's swept in now, and we can see he's really laying the groundwork so to make sure that his system and his policies stay in power long after even he's gone.
I don't expect that too many of the analysts who are sort of clinging to any wisp of hope that there may be a change in Iran would be too quick to acknowledge that this is not a good sign, that this isn't heading in the right direction. You still have people who like to pretend that Iran is a democracy. But if you're looking at this with clear eyes, you recognize that is a sham, that there's any pretense of democracy is nothing but that, a pretense. Can you just talk about what this may signal about Iran's policy going forward? You mentioned specifically about Parliament's role in choosing the next supreme leader. Is there any other indication of what this might mean for Iran's policy going forward and how this may tie in with biblical prophecy?
Absolutely. Well, I mean, another thing that this does is it just it shores up the Ayatollah's grounding. Technically speaking, according to their laws, the parliament along with the president do have the power to impeach. We've been hearing a lot about that in America, but of course, I mean, with this parliament and with the Guardian Council as it is, I mean, it's never going to happen. Mm-hmm. And so, what we see is that, you know, the Ayatollah, by removing any last remnants of anything that seems remotely moderate, we can see that he's just shoring up his ground there. But harkening back to what you were saying about prophecy, when we see the parliament, they the decisions that they get to make, they can approve more military funding, things like that. They don't have as much of a sway in foreign policy as it does when it, as as the Ayatollah, you know, makes all those calls, and he's backed up by the Iranian Revolutionary Guard. But certainly they do have a lot of sway on policy at home. And I think when the Ayatollah has radicalized the parliament like he has, he's trying to, I think, play off of the death of Qasem Soleimani and maybe try and just whip up a little bit of fervor. And we do know that in, to a large extent, Iran is on the rise. They are ascendant. We know that Bible prophecy indicates that they are a power, or they lead a power, an Islamic power called the King of the South, which we've spoken of often. We have a booklet on the King of the South, which people can read if they want a lot more detail on that. But, I mean, when you have a parliament that enacts policies at home that are very hardline, and it completely backs the Guardian Council, which is militarily backed by the Iranian Revolutionary Guard, which follows explicitly the orders of a radical terrorist, the Ayatollah. I mean, you can just see that when the whole head of Iran's parliamentary system, of its whole political system even, is completely radicalized, the nation has no choice. I mean, the common people of Iran, we see them protesting, and your heart does go out for some of these people with the sanctions that are on them at the moment, and the situation a lot of the common people find themselves in. Even, I mean, not everyone in Iran, I'm sure, is in agreement with what the Ayatollah is doing, but they have no choice. I mean, the military, the whole political system now, especially as we see with this election coming up, is being extremely radicalized, which falls exactly into what we see in Daniel 11, verse 40 through 43. We see the King of the South, we see it clashing with other foreign powers around the world, you know, powers that far outmatch its own abilities. But we see this reckless, radical policy, and as Iran pushes its regional objectives. We can even see it today. We don't even need to open our Bibles to see Iran on the rise. We look at Syria, we look at Iraq, we look all over, we see Iran in North Africa, everywhere. Iran is working feverishly. Yemen, the list goes on and on. We can see Iran is on the rise, that they're pushing hard. And the Ayatollah now, I mean, he has no opposition at home apart from those protesters on the street. But what choice do they have when the military is against them, when the whole political beast is against them as well?
Pretty fascinating to watch, given those prophecies. The election, the Iranian parliamentary elections are this coming Friday. And not necessarily a whole lot of mystery, not necessarily much question as to how this is going to turn out. But we've been talking with trumpet writer Callum Wood about these elections in Iran. He's written an article about this subject. You can find it on thetrumpet.com, the title of that article, Iran Prepares for Hardline Parliament. Go check it out. Thanks very much for your time, Callum. Appreciate you talking to us.
Thanks for having me back on the show.
This is Trumpet Hour with Joel Hilliker.
These days, growing awareness of nutrition has led to an explosion of highly restrictive diets that promise significant weight loss and health benefit, from keto to raw food, vegan to low fat. When it comes to finding a diet that's right for you, there are a whole lot of choices, but so many of these diets say that a narrow dietary focus is what will solve your physical and mental problems, or will ensure longevity, produce greater life satisfaction. It's a reality, though, that when you try one of these fad diets, it's hard to sustain in the long run. To talk about this, we have via Skype from his office in British Columbia, holistic nutritionist Jörg Mardian. Hello, Jörg.
Hello there.
So I imagine that you encounter a lot of different diets, or people come to you with questions like, well, what do you think of this? I found this new diet out here. What's your thought about it? Maybe you could just tell us from your vantage point as a nutritionist what we're looking at with this trend in extreme dieting.
Right. Well, just to lay a foundation, I believe extreme dieting is just a result of our bodily conditions today. You know, the statistics say there's 160 million Americans annually that are spending about $20 billion on weight loss schemes every year.
This is half of the population is spending on diets.
Yeah. So, I mean, the numbers are staggering. And the desperation is apparent in that attempt. But consumers are really put off by the time commitments. And so they keep buying into the same pitch time and again. And when you look at diets, myself as a nutritionist, I counsel moderation. I counsel patience and time. I counsel let the body do its work. Whereas advertisers say, go for it. Give me 7 days and I'll rip it off.
You know? Right.
And so an extreme diet would be something where you would severely restrict calories or entire food groups. And what that includes in extreme diet is a repetitive behavior with negative consequences. So that's what we're looking at when we're really defining that. So when you severely restrict the amount of food that your body needs, you're basically starving it of calories. Calories, your body needs a certain amount for energy. We know that.
Yeah.
So you're going below that energy threshold, and as well as you will not meet the nutrients that your body needs. So it's going to result in a slower metabolism, first of all. And that leads to future weight gain. So you're setting yourself up for failure on that front, the very thing that you're trying to avoid. You're going to have a weakened immune system. You're going to have possibly heart palpitations, cardiac stress. I mean, doctors are saying you keep meddling in this stuff and you risk a heart attack. It has severe repercussions. A lot of people don't realize that. And as well, when you can look at the issue of restrictions themselves becoming a disorder. So this diet, you know, when you're working with this diet, it becomes a mental issue. There's a program called the Emily Program, and they deal with eating disorders, a very unique program. And they've determined that holding back nourishment from the body can change or can lead to an emotionally changed relationship with food. You know, so you have this excessive preoccupation with calories, with foods. It becomes a negative thing in your mind. It becomes an enemy. Food is no longer a pleasure or it no longer serves to bring nourishment to the body. It damages you in your mind, you know. And so they say you're going to get feelings of guilt and low self-esteem because these severe restrictions cause you to fail time and again. They're just not sustainable. And so what they see is binge eating and more weight gain.
Yeah. So now I want just to interject one thought there. It does seem like there are a lot of people who are an increasing number of people who are required to have some pretty severe restrictions in their diets because of food allergies or problems that certain kinds of foods create in them. And it does seem like there are some of these diets that are kind of aimed at eliminating the negative effects that the body is having against certain foods. What you're talking about is different than, say, that type of thing.
I'm talking general dieting.
Yeah.
We're looking at a lot of weight loss in America.
Right.
A lot of rotundness that has to change. We want to change it, and we're going to do anything we can to change it, no matter if it's damaging or not. We're not really thinking about it. That's what I'm talking about. And the problem is that some people have a biological predisposition to disorders. They just don't know it. So what I've just stated doesn't apply to everyone. Mm-hmm. But the Emily program said, when there's less food than the body needs, sometimes it creates a condition that may trigger a hidden genetic problem that you're going to get into with this, and then you start getting into food disorders.
So can you just give us some examples of what you're seeing that you'd characterize as extreme?
Well, when you look at extreme diets, there's no shortage of craziness. I'll just give you some ingredients, and you can apply them any way you want. I'm sure you won't want to. tapeworms, staples, cotton balls, soap, feeding tubes, even plain air. I've heard people subside on air. I've seen this written. So that's pretty crazy. I mean, we're going to look at that and just say, who would try this? People try it. Now, and then there's heavily restricted calories and nutrients, as we talked about, to achieve a result. So some examples of these, just to give you an idea, would be taking a singular food as well, like a grapefruit diet or cabbage soup or potato diet, fruits or juicing, you know, and just saying, I'm going to try this diet for 6 weeks.
So some of those things you might do, say, for a short time as part of a cleanse or that type of thing, that even that would be a little different than what you're talking about, like a longer term diet.
That's exactly it. A judicious approach to a cleansing diet is very healthy.
Yeah,
it actually is. It gives your body a reset. But this long term approach, saying a little is good and a lot is better, that's really what I'm talking about, extremism, mm-hmm. where we start to do damage to the body, and then the body fights back, mm-hmm. you know, and it nips us in the butt. And I also wanted to address the, there's a popular approach called the ketogenic diet. It's just the hottest thing right now, everywhere you look. Mm-hmm. And that's a high-fat, adequate protein diet, and it typically restricts your carbs to about 5% of your total daily calories. It's not a lot. Now, what I'll say is this diet brings undeniable therapeutic benefits. We've seen it. We know, especially towards metabolic syndrome, insulin resistance, type 2 diabetes, seizures. We've seen some amazing things. So if you suffer from these conditions, this diet may help. And I think that's what we're talking about. If you have some kind of condition, let's take out anything that can harm you. You may be allergic to something, you know, you're just taking stuff out and saying, let's really reset and see what the body does. Mm-hmm. The problem with this approach, though, is that even this diet is aimed at weight loss. And the perception is that the ketosis is the vehicle for this aim. But the studies show that any diet that reduces calorie intake, like low fat, low carb, Weight Watchers, paleo, any of those followed long term are likely going to lead to weight loss over time if you stick to them. They're restrictive diets. I'm not saying they're all correct, but there's no magic ingredient. You're simply saying, look, if you're 150 pounds overweight and you're trying the ketogenic diet and it's working for you, well, all the best to you. But who wants to live with a restriction that just shuts you out of everything? Every restaurant, everywhere you visit, you know, your relatives. And it's so hard to maintain for most people, not all, mm-hmm. you know, that there's an enormous dropout rate. Mm-hmm. So my point is, why set yourself up for failure when there's another way to do so?
Okay, well, let's talk about the other way. If putting yourself on severe caloric restrictions or eliminating whole types of food from your diet is difficult to sustain in the long run, what do you say for the long run?
Well, for the long run, we have to look at, first of all, calories over, not choosing calories over quality. Mm-hmm. And that's a big mistake, because the current nutritional dogma says it doesn't matter what you eat, it only matters how many calories food contains. And apparently, I need to say this, all calories are not created equal. Mm-hmm. Calories count, but instead of us prioritizing them and weighing everything and counting everything, just eat better. You know, a low quality, low calorie food is just going to cause an insulin surge and ultimately contribute to weight gain. Mm-hmm. Whole foods, on the other hand, they decrease insulin levels for the most part in the moderate amounts, and they prevent fat storage. And the funny thing is, when we count calories, the more we count them, the less we pay attention to the food quality. And the key point is, if calorie counting was effective, America would be the thinnest population in the world. my point is really strategic moderation. And I really like that term. So strategic moderation, we would use, first of all, we would look at quality of food. You know, stick to whole foods, lots of fruits and veggies. We know those are good for us. Lean protein, healthy fats, and some whole grains. Now, the latter part, the grains, the less you move, the less carbohydrates you need of a good quality, the good carbohydrates. And if you're sensitive to them, dial them back to balance according to your need. I can't stress that enough. If you're not moving, just take a lot of them out, mm-hmm. you know. For quantity, that's where you use strategic moderation. And there's no scientific definition really of moderation. You know, first and foremost, it's a biblical principle. You know, Philippians 4:5 says, let your moderation be known unto all men. To me, that's a guiding principle. Mm-hmm. To other people, they may say, well, you know, that's still subjective. I don't know what that really means. So I would say use it in the term of avoiding extremes and being cognizant of your portion size. So I'll just quickly give the portion size that you can really have a picture of. For women, that means a thumb. If you hold up your thumb, a thumb of fat-dense foods, a palm portion of protein. You know, so looking at your palm, a fistful of veggies and a cup of whole carb foods if you can tolerate those. So if you're looking at a meal, you're not going to gain weight on that for most people. For men, double that portion. So now if you're very active, adjust your protein and carbohydrate intake according to what you need. So it's a very unique thing to everybody. Nobody's the same. The key is make sure you have variety and you have those macronutrients, your fats, your carbohydrates, and your proteins in every meal. Just imagine one of those little trays you get in restaurant. In the hospital. And, you know, they're very – so if you can fill those, then you have your meal. You're not going to overeat. Mm-hmm. It's really looking at very good food in those pockets, mm-hmm. you know.
So would you say there is a segment of the population that would do the strategic moderation that you're suggesting and still not receive the results that they're hoping for?
Absolutely. And that's really why – the profession of nutrition exists, nutritionists. We have to get people to look at that and say, what is wrong here? Like, why isn't this working? You know, why am I so different? I'm still, I want to lose weight. You know, usually I say, well, do you continue to find it in the refrigerator, the weight? But if not, if you're lacking, or if you're lacking willpower, but if that's not the case and it's still not working, my recommendation is intermittent fasting. I really love it. And that's where you strategically skip one or more meals for a set period of time. And the 16-8 method involves eating within an 8-hour window daily and then fasting for 16 hours. And that's really not as hard as it sounds. Mm-hmm. For example, you're going to sleep on 8 hours anyways.
Yeah.
That's fasting. So you may skip breakfast and eat between 12 and 8 p.m. And after a while, you're really not hungry between that period of time. Make sure when you're eating, it's very nutritious. You know, the health benefits of the people rave about this, of the weight loss and the improved digestion and the mood and the ability to crush sugar cravings are amazing on intermittent fasting. Hmm. You know, it just optimizes your body's ability to burn fat. So that's another way that you can use on top of what I've said before. The answer to becoming healthy is really simpler and safer than extreme diets. So eating is never meant to push a boundary. It's meant to provide satisfaction and wellness. That's what eating is about. And the same with dieting. So use your nutrition plan as a long-term tool of moderation and quality in your food choices. Do some exercising, and that'll help you to modulate weight loss and then your overall health.
Well, very interesting. It does seem like you've got plenty on your plate when you're trying to tailor an individual program for you know, whoever it is out there that with whatever problems that they're facing. But you gave us some really good basic principles that should apply to the vast majority of us. We do appreciate that. We've been talking with Jorg Mardian, a holistic nutritionist, about extreme dieting. And he's working on an article about this, and you can watch for that on thetrumpet.com. Thanks as usual, Jorg. Very interesting.
Thank you.
It's time for today's last word.
During the second week of November, students at some American universities were so emotionally distraught they couldn't take a test. Professors said, well, we'll postpone the examinations. What life trauma struck them and perhaps their professors all at the same time? Well, it was the electoral victory of Donald Trump. Elsewhere, you had weeping supporters of Hillary Clinton crying on the sidewalks, marching through the streets, screaming profanities, posting hateful threats online, spray paint on the sides of buildings. This was an amazing example of young liberals catastrophizing. This is having sky is falling emotional meltdowns over normal, non-apocalyptic events. There was an article about this phenomenon in The Atlantic about a year ago. It's called The Coddling of the American Mind. And the authors noted an example in Yale University where the administrators, they told the students, don't wear certain costumes on Halloween. And there was a professor that gently suggested through an email that students should make up their own minds. They should take responsibility for their own decisions. And then if there were any offenses, just talk about it. Have a mature conversation about it. Well, some Yale students were so offended by the idea that there would be actually people who could wear costumes that were deemed culturally offensive. They started skipping class. They started skipping courses. They said they were losing sleep. They were suffering emotional breakdowns. And they vulgarly and publicly attacked the email's author and her husband and demanded that they be fired. Whatever young liberals are learning or not learning right now in American institutions of higher education, they are definitely learning how to be offended. They're definitely learning how to let their emotions slip from the leash. Now, giving offense can certainly be a form of evil, but so can taking offense. Victim thinking, hypersensitivity, this is happening more and more, and it's not just on elitist college campuses. It's a spirit that fills our age, and we're all susceptible to it. If you don't recognize it and kick it out, it's going to fill your mind. The fact is, if you fail to master your emotions, you're not really running your own life. You're susceptible to emotional manipulation from all directions, from people you hate, from people you like, from forces far beyond your control. Proverbs 25 and verse 28 sums it up really well. It says, he that has no rule over his own spirit is like a city that is broken down and without walls. There is so much evidence in what is happening in the world today to show how true that really is. Unrestrained emotion is a force so potent that it can engulf and endanger entire countries. It's endangering America today. It's endangering other nations today. Now, what's going on here with emotion? When we take offense, we naturally react with negative emotion. And emotion is not weakness. It's not a flaw in human beings. It's not an evolutionary quirk. It's something that God created. It's part of what makes us human beings. Emotion can be one of the most enjoyable blessings that we possess. Without it, our lives would be bland, flat, colorless, hardly worth living. Our relationships would be boring. Our jobs would be monotonous. God gave us the power of feeling so we can experience joy and love. We can have real deep relationships. We can even experience anger and jealousy, fear, sadness. Through emotion, we experience a lot of variety, a lot of depth of thought. And it comes from God because he is emotional. He experiences love. He experiences joy and hatred and anger, indignation, jealousy, concern, grief, sorrow, compassion. There are a lot of scriptures that show God demonstrating these emotions. Now, he doesn't have the physiological changes that we experience with emotion, but he has deep, powerful, profound states of mind, and he created human beings in his likeness for the purpose of growing to become like him. And really, when you put it all together, it's it's clear that God gave us these physiological changes in our bodies in order to help us understand the depth of his thinking. So when we learn to manage our emotions, we're learning to think like God. Emotion is a great gift. It's not the opposite of and a counter to reason. Emotion and reason actually work together beautifully. They are motivational tools that really complement and enhance each other when you master your emotions. How skilled are you at handling this critical part of your life? Are you constantly buffeted toward the extremes of the emotional spectrum? Or on the other hand, are you casual or indifferent about things that you really should feel deeply about? You probably don't scream demands that people be fired when they uphold freedom of speech. You're not rioting over election results you don't like, but it's important to think about how you take offense and maybe the subtler ways that you react negatively. Why do you get offended? Well, there are a lot of reasons why we take offense. You can think of many specific reasons. Maybe you feel someone is criticizing something you did, or you feel they should have given you more credit. Someone isn't giving you the respect you deserve, or you're sensitive about some problem in your life you haven't dealt with. You're upset by someone else's superficial quirks or imperfections, or you're upset when they fail to measure up to your expectations, or you assume someone else's actions are caused by the very worst motives. The common thread in all of these situations where we take offense is vanity. It is self-love and self-righteousness. It's the wrong kind of pride. And where does that come from? Well, the Bible actually reveals the author of that thinking, and that is Satan the devil. Satan is the god of this world who deceives the whole world. You can see that in Revelation 12 and verse 9, 2 Corinthians 4, 4. And he was the author of sin. The essence of that sinful attitude that first started in him was self-love. It says in Ezekiel that his heart was lifted up because of his own beauty. Now, God had created that beauty, but he became lifted up because of it. And that attitude is the opposite of the outflowing love of God. Under the devil's influence, the world today exalts self-love. It promotes taking offense as a kind of pursuit of justice, like it's going to make the world better and fairer and more peaceful, but it will not. It will never work. In fact, that wrongful self-love can be found at the source of all offense, interpersonal friction, conflict, hatred, emotional pain and suffering. If you nurture it, if you encourage it, that's always going to lead to more problems. In fact, in the Bible, the Greek word for offended is skandalon, and that can refer to the triggering of a trap. If you take offense, it's a trap for you. You succumb to negativity and resentment and debilitating emotion. Those who go about establishing their own righteousness, self-righteousness, rather than submitting to God's righteousness, the Bible says that they're going to suffer for that. The self-righteous person is very attuned to what he perceives as everyone else's flaws. Anytime there's a conflict, he feels like it's the other person's fault. He takes quick offense. He feels like the victim. That's exactly the way Satan thinks. I'm going to talk next week about how to overcome offense. I'm Joel Hilliker, and that will do it for today's Trumpet Hour. You can send me any thoughts on today's program to letters@thetrumpet.com. Thanks to my guests, Richard Palmer, Callum Wood, and Jörg Mardian. Thanks to Nick Irwin and Dwight Falk for engineering and production. I'll leave you with this thought from Carl Menninger: set up as an ideal the facing of reality as honestly and as cheerfully as possible. Thank you for joining us on Trumpet Hour. Until next time, keep watching your world.
You've been listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG. And online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.